through requests for information and planning and technical analysis of claims made by KiwiRail. Some information gaps remain, leading to what we submit as being a cautious approach taken by the reporting officers to some of those issues. And we acknowledge it's open to the panel to conclude that the approach taken and recommended by the reporting officers should have been either more or less cautious in some areas of overlap. But the reporting officers invite the panel to reach their conclusions in those areas with a high degree of certainty. The officers wish to emphasise that they are, again, not seeking to usurp the role of the Regional Council in any of those areas, but rather they are seeking to alleviate the uncertainty described above and ultimately ensure that there are no gaps in the holistic management of the freight hub's effects. Now I'm just going to turn to noise. At paragraph 87, KiwiRail's requirement raises a serious issue about noise. This is perhaps the resource management issue that most sharply brings into focus the evaluative principles discussed earlier in these submissions. It has been the most talked about effect by submitters, and it is the most important effect for KiwiRail to have gotten right in its assessment of effects. The panel has now heard many intelligent and emotional critiques of the noise assessment and the impact that the freight hub will have on the lives of a neighbouring community. With those submissions front of mind, the panel will have to carefully consider the noise evidence that it has available to it, drawing on its own evaluative expertise to make an appropriate judgment. In the context of KiwiRail's flexible approach to this designation, the evaluative exercise will require giving special attention to the conditions so as to clearly establish appropriate bottom lines for noise effects. This task engages with the panel's discussion with Ms. Tancock about whether KiwiRail's proposed condition sets out hard limits or only soft limits. In other words, the panel must consider whether the conditions establish standards that truly capture the approach that KiwiRail says it intended to achieve when it discusses how its requirement sets an envelope for effects. As to conditions, Mr. Lloyd has exhaustively reviewed the noise evidence, with many recommendations arising in respect of appropriate conditions. While many of Mr. Lloyd's recommendations have now been adopted by KiwiRail over the various iterations of the conditions, differences of opinion remain about some aspects, which are appropriately addressed by Mr. Lloyd. As correctly observed by Ms. Tancock, however, he has done the best with what was available to him. Ultimately, following consideration of the evidence and what mitigation can be appropriately achieved through conditions, there is a remaining overall question of the acceptability of the noise effect on the receiving environment that must be determined. In undertaking its evaluation, the panel might find some assistance in the following discussion, which addresses some of the issues that have been discussed. The first issue I want to address is the question about how to treat the noise from the NIMT, the North Island Main Trunk. The recently completed joint witness statement on acoustics confirms that the noise model used by KiwiRail does not include noise from the NIMT. The joint witness statement goes on to acknowledge that the proposed noise management boundary would likely need to expand slightly if noise from the NIMT were included in the model, but the NIMT noise has never been assessed. It is not entirely clear whether KiwiRail considers the presence of the NIMT and its noise as part of the receiving environment or as part of the permitted baseline or both. However, the panel prefers to conceptualise it. It is relevant to the assessment of the designation's noise effects on the environment that there is an existing major railway line within the designation extent and sitting within its own designation. However, the size and scale of the noise and vibration effects of the proposed freight hub will be greater than the noise of the NIMT currently, perhaps by orders of magnitude. While a permitted baseline may apply to a designation, it is submitted to be a discretionary consideration. Council proposes that the approach when considering whether to apply a permitted baseline, adapting the Lyttelton Harbour case, is for the panel to formulate its recommendations based on the facts of this designation, decide if there's a reasonable comparability between the permitted baseline and the proposed activity, so as to justify the application of it. Third, to require detailed evidence of any theoretical permitted activity. Fourth, to determine whether the baseline activity is similar in purpose to that which is proposed, having regard to the planning framework. And last, to decide whether or not the baseline will nevertheless serve the overall purpose of the Act. The effect of the existing NIMT designation are not discussed in great detail in the noise context, again, as they have not been assessed. However, the difference in the nature and scale of noise and vibration effects from the freight hub as compared to the NIMT currently could suggest that it is inappropriate, based on three of the above factors, to apply a permitted baseline here. Nevertheless, the panel may consider otherwise. In terms of forming part of the receiving environment, the NIMT exists within the proposed designation extent and currently generates noise and vibration effects. However, KiwiRail notes that the North Island main trunk will need to be relocated within the freight hub. Moving the NIMT in our submission is a core part of this project, and accordingly not properly looked at as being part of the receiving environment. Further, KiwiRail anticipates that the freight hub will generate additional rail traffic along the North Island main trunk through shunting on the NIMT. Together with the movement of the track, this will generate different, we're carefully using the word different as opposed to greater or less there, different noise and vibration effects originating both within and without the designation extent to the ones currently experienced by neighbouring properties. And at 98, our submission is that the concept of the existing environment is essentially about measuring the change to an environment that will be caused by a proposal, where the effects to be measured are those which are not already impacting on the receiving environment. Conceptually, it does not fit well to entirely disregard the noise effects of the NIMT when the proposal is to move it, causing a change to the receiving environment in conjunction with other noisy aspects of the proposal. To disregard the effects of the North Island main trunk altogether deprives the panel of information necessary to measure the change. In any case, when assessing the effects of the designation on the environment, the panel is entitled to consider the impacts of the freight hub in combination with the existing North Island main trunk, where the two activities create cumulative noise impacts. As the noise effects of the main trunk have not yet been modelled, it is difficult to assess its noise and vibration effect in combination with the effects of the freight hub. The confirmation from Dr. Childs that the noise management boundary would need to move out if the main trunk were factored into his model suggests that at least some of the time there will be synergistic noise effects between the two. If this is the case, it will be worth the panel considering these cumulative effects as an effect of the designation on the environment. This follows even more strongly than it otherwise might in the context of the noise conditions, as the specific mitigation method proposed, which is a noise management boundary, is formulated to avoid an environmental bottom line from being crossed in the area. As such, it is submitted that the panel can take into account what will actually be experienced by people in the area, factoring in the effects of the main trunk when considering its recommendation on the formulation of condition 85, so limits at the boundary, and the proposed condition set more broadly. Now I want to address this idea that's come up about designating more land, which generated some discussion at the start of the hearing. So while discussing the broader questions as to noise in his report, the panel will recall discussion about Mr. Lloyd's suggestion that the designated boundaries should have been drawn more broadly to take account for noise effects, that cannot be internalised. And just for clarity here, the reporting officers have not advised the panel that it should recommend expanding the designation. In our submission, such a recommendation would engage challenging questions of scope and the magnitude of any extensions that are simply not suitably addressed in this forum. In that context, considering the narrow question of whether the designation should be broadened is something of a red herring. However, in our submission, the suggestion from Mr. Loy does draw some focus to issues that do remain relevant concerning the effectiveness of the mitigation proposed by KiwiRail, the overall noise assessment, and what this all means for people who will be affected. For example, some of the concerns expressed by various submitters and Mr. Lloyd are that, firstly, the proposed noise mitigation method of offering additional home insulation upgrades and ventilation will not necessarily be suitable or desirable, in particular for those who enjoy opening their windows at night time. Secondly, even accounting for the above mitigation, submitters observed that their rural or rural residential lifestyles include enjoying the entirety of their properties. Ms. Tancock addressed this and she referred to the Environment Court's decision in Westwind. Thirdly, residents within the 55 decibel noise boundary are predicted to experience noise that is assessed to be incompatible with residential activity. And fourth, while attention can be given to conditions to ensure that hard limits are fixed at noise management boundaries, and that's the reporting officer's expectation, there is a residual uncertainty still about what noise-generating activities will actually take place on the site until such time as detailed design of it is completed. Ultimately, the freight hub operation will markedly change the oral amenity experienced by existing neighbours. And this is a noise effect with broad applicability in this context, taking into account the amenity values under the Act, which does include the physical characteristics of an area that contribute to people's appreciation of its pleasantness, aesthetic coherence, and cultural and recreational attributes. In our submission, the Act intends to manage effects arising from the use of land on the principle that the person undertaking the activity bears the responsibility for avoiding, remedying, or mitigating the effects of it. In this case, however, KiwiRail seeks to redistribute that responsibility by imposing the obligation to absorb noise effects within the receiving environment. Those left to absorb the effects will be left in an unenviable position, either with their amenity compromised by the noise effects or with few options to relocate if they reach the subjective decision that they are not prepared to accept the reduced amenity. It is relevant to consider that in circumstances where first-order effects such as noise cannot be internalised, it is also logical to assume that the second-order effects will arise, such as effects on land valuation or the viability of these locations for residential dwellings. While a broader requirement, or wider requirement, would not ultimately decrease the amount of noise that comes from the freight hub, it could have provided those persons affected by the noise but outside the designation the agency to choose between more options that should they find that they were unable to accept that reduced amenity. It could also have formed an effective restriction on further establishment of inconsistent residential activity. In this context, the panel has inquired whether a claim for injurious affection would be available for those people, even if their land is not designated. Section 63 of the Public Works Act provides limited assistance here. It allows for circumstances where land is not taken, but where there is substantial injurious affection to a person's land caused by the construction, but not the maintenance or operation of a public work. This tool does not appear to be a statutory tool that would effectively respond to the noise effects arising from the operation of the freight hub, although it has some potential utility for the construction phase. In summary, the concerns with the noise effects are the level of effect that will be experienced by neighbours beyond the boundaries of the designation and the limitations of the available range of conditions to address those effects, particularly given that the remedies of Section 185 are not available, and Section 185 is the provision in the RMA that allows a person with a designation over their land to ask the Environment Court to order it be purchased off them. Further to the need to control noise through hard limits at established noise management boundaries, should the panel consider that these matters and the views expressed by submitters require addressing, it may like to express to Kiwi Rail that a nausea condition would be one way to address those concerns. Such an approach may better align to Kiwi Rail's good neighbour responsibilities as a requiring authority to have proper regard to the interests of those affected.
I'll just ask you a couple of questions because sure. I think you're moving to a different topic. In fact, the topic that Mr. Sinclair might be addressing us on. There's this interesting question about the NIMT, some of which may be affected by the conditions proposed. As I understand it, there is intended to be a hard limit, albeit potentially at the notional boundary rather than the hard, or than the site boundary of 65 dBA. Is that correct?
Correct.
And when you describe that as a bottom line, is that a bottom line in the sense that it's an assessment by Mr. Lloyd of really the minimum requirements needed for reasonable use of a residential property?
Well, I just want to be careful that I don't get things wrong, but it is certainly a minimum limit.
Yeah.
Yes, as to a limit as to reasonable use of a person's property.
Yeah.
I'd have to go back and check against the language that those limits were sort of formulated on, because my understanding is that they derive from Dr. Charles' assessment, where he describes what those limits are.
Right.
Certainly it is a minimum threshold.
Yeah. And are you inviting us to invite an OSIA condition in respect of those properties that are modelled for 65 to experience 65 dBA on the
Well,
model? Because there's a range of potential effects, aren't there?
I think, sir, you will have noticed I've been quite careful not to specify what that OSIA condition is.
Yeah.
Because it's very hard for us to sit here and postulate what that condition must say or what the parameters on it must be. I think it's quite logical for an OSIA condition to latch on to that 65 dBA limit if persons are modelled to experience noise higher than that. And Mr. Lloyd may have a view on that as well. But I can't remember the submitter's name, Gore, perhaps, who spoke and suggested that the kind of condition that he would like is a condition whereby if a resident within that area is not prepared to accept the mitigation and they are affected to a certain degree, then Kiwi Rail would make an offer for them to purchase their property so that they'd have the choice to move on. Now, I haven't wanted to have a go at specifying what such an OSIA condition may look like, but it is that kind of OSIA condition that I had in mind, where there was some kind of a an offer made by KiwiRail as an OSIA condition that latches to certain objective thresholds that would provide those most affected by the noise with an option to say, this isn't for me, effectively, or whatever their subjective rationale might be. And like you, sir, I'm missing their name from my brain, but those
there's
residents...
a gentleman with the three structures on his property in the corner.
Yes, but also I was thinking about the submitters who had the two sons with sensory effects. So accepting that we can't craft all these conditions to respond to subjective... Woodfields might be the submitter's name. So accepting we can't necessarily craft a set of conditions that respond to the subjective needs on people, certainly recognising that some people will have subjective needs, which requires them to, or might end up with them wanting to choose a different lifestyle that's suitable for them. And our submission is that perhaps it's appropriate that those people not be left stuck in a situation where they don't have anywhere to go but to basically accept the offer on the table by KiwiRail for home insulation.
You correctly sort of described the thing as evaluative, and essentially the proposal is a backfill of a inland port into an area which has existing residential development, and if it was planned forward, you wouldn't allow the housing in that location. And the district plan has standards for noise that reflect the expectations of the community around noise amenity in certain locations. That reflects the historical development of the city. And when you have a project that potentially has significant social benefits, inevitably you're going to come up against those sorts of edge effects occurring in locations that ordinarily would be regarded as undesirable. Recognising that it's evaluative, are we really having to make an assessment that for the common good, for want of a better phrase, some people may have to carry effects that would otherwise be regarded as unacceptable in other locations within the city where they reside?
Well, it's inevitable that some people are going to carry effects. And I agree that noise is part of the evaluation under Section 104, and it's not the only issue that you're evaluating. It includes the significant benefits that come from this project. What I'm inviting the panel to consider is that it might well be, after you've finished talking with Mr. Lloyd, that you consider there is a serious issue with noise and that it will affect a lot of people and at a high level. And after you look at that issue in conjunction with the conditions that are available, it might be that the panel reaches a condition that's a significant imposition upon the lives of those people, and it's asking them to absorb a lot. And there is a question there as to whether more can be done for those residents. And we're inviting the panel to consider that.
I guess signalling to Mr. Lloyd, what I'm interested in is, based on his experience, what is his experience of an acceptable environmental bottom line, recognising that he shouldn't bring the lens of what we would apply to the residential zone, because that's not the type of question we're faced in this context. And so that's the sort of where I'm trying to feel my way to, is where is that bottom line, recognising that it's not only our job but it's the acousticians to say, well, where you have significant potential public benefits in a retrofit,
yes,
where is there a line that you would say beyond that it's an unreasonable imposition? And then following from that, there comes the question, I think you made the good point about the extent to which the permitted baseline or the receiving environment analysis is relevant where you approach an environmental limit or bottom line. And I guess what I think you're saying is if the NIMT alone would not have imposed that bottom line, is it correct to then set a bottom line which may be exceeded by including the NIMT? Is that the question that you're putting to us?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. The noise management boundary is essentially setting that threshold. It is Mr. Lloyd's recommendation that there be a limit set at that boundary. And you're quite right. The point is that boundary is as a limit or a threshold for acceptability within it is a little bit illusory if you also have to factor in additional noise, which would make it wider by some margin, I'm not sure how much.
If we set a hard limit,
yes,
and the effect of that operation is to constrain KiwiRail in 40 years' time, then in 40 years' time they can designate those houses and acquire them at the appropriate time. I mean, like, why isn't the limit the effective tool as opposed to an invitation to acquire now?
Sir, I think the as soon as this requirement is made and you have that limit in place, one of what you call those secondary effects on those properties, in the sense that immediately those people will be subject to having a set of essentially district plan rules that allows for noise to be experienced within it at levels, even with that threshold applying, that Dr. Charles would describe as inconsistent with residential activity.
Well, that might be exceeding the bottom line, but let's just say for argument's sake, because I think you gave the example of the Woodfields, I think that's their name, where clearly you're not exceeding those bottom lines, but let's just say it's a second-tier situation. Parliament hasn't seen fit to provide compensatory mechanisms for effects associated with operation and maintenance of these facilities. Does that statutory scheme suggest that what we should be looking at is setting limits and those secondary consequences are, as one person I think described it, as just taking one for the team? I'm just putting it because it seems to me interesting that the statutory structure of the Public Works Act doesn't appear to recognise those injurious affection effects.
Well, that's accurate. The provision I pointed you to just seems to cover the operation of it, but I would suggest that that might well be appropriate when one considers something like a roading project where you're in and out and then you're left with the operation of a road. Parliament might well have not expected injurious affection to be appropriate for that kind of project. But what we've got here is a noise management boundary set to encompass a wide range of residential activities and noise effects that will that are significant and not internalised. And in my submission, what you would often see in a case like this is the use of the boundaries of the notice of requirement to create that sort of effective buffer for those activities. And so it comes from the way that the boundaries of the notice of requirement have been kept very narrow to the project itself, but no wider. That is what's depriving those people of actually having that kind of compensation or opportunities available to them to get out of there. So in relation to your comment that there's no statutory scheme expressly available to those people, I would say that the actual designation process that we're in right now and the ability to broaden those boundaries to account for those houses and the effects of the activity is part of that statutory scheme and quite possibly is what Parliament intended to provide those people with the options. And Section 185 specifically would have been that option.
Yeah, oh, I think I understand that.
Can I just interject there? But on the other hand, Mr. Jessen, we have seen examples of notices of requirement around the country which have had similar conditions and things imposed on them. For example, Transmission Gully is one in terms of noise, where there are such conditions. So can you comment on that, please? And how does your argument apply to that sort of situation where there are?
What such conditions are you referring to?
Well, the ones where of acoustic treatment and requiring other mitigation or offering other mitigation as well.
Well, Commissioner, I'm not saying that those conditions are wrong or bad. The question for the commissioners is whether that is sufficient here in light of the significance of the effect.
Right.
And I'm saying that it's for the commissioners to, I suppose, talk and investigate the evidence of Mr. Lloyd against Dr. Charles, make its own conclusion about whether or not that's acceptable, even with all those conditions that are before the panel now, for those people. And if it reaches a conclusion that, well, actually, this is not a good thing here, consider its options about the other ways in which that might be addressed. And one of the ways that Mr. Lloyd has talked about is, well, wouldn't this have all been nicer if the designation was a bit broader to begin with? That's not available here, so we're sort of left at the bottom of the barrel, submitting gently to the commissioners that the only other way that we can think of to address this problem, if you think it is a problem, is by way of an OSIA condition.
Okay, thank you.
Occurred to me, and it's probably more of a statement than a question, that if the designation was broader, there might be a lot of people who say, who come to us, like in the Castle movie, and say, well, Sydney Airport may need a noise to quiet my land, but I want to retain it. There is a way in which I suppose the OSIA condition is an opt-in, but it is also a wrong conclusion to say every person would want to leave their property because of those noise effects.
I agree with that, and I'm also not submitting that everybody will want to leave. But the position they're in right now is that their only option to leave is to sell, and it is to sell in a planning context where they have a freight hub generating this effect right next to them. So the benefit, again, it's a slight red herring to talk about broadening the NOR because You know, for the reason you just mentioned, sir, not everyone would be happy with that.
Yeah, so we would have the castle situation.
Yes. But in its absence, there is a lack of agency for those people who are affected. There is a lack of option but to either accept the upgrade offers that are on the table or to live with it, so to speak, and take the loss. And that doesn't also consider the effects on people outside the house, which is another concern that Mr. Lloyd has.
Yeah, I was just pushing back on the idea that it's always the case that in a designation situation you would acquire everything that you needed to embrace all effects that were beyond a certain level. Because there might be strategic and other good reasons not to do that. And that's why I came back to this limit point and in a way,
yep,
saying, well, use those sorts of techniques, but recognise that they won't be the same levels that would be applied in Palmerston North historically because it is an ahistorical situation.
Yes, it is, yes. And that's quite right. There's an acceptability point in evaluation there.
Yeah,
that's
I
for
think
you.
That's right.
But, yeah. We're driving at the limited range of options available for those people.
Yeah.
Should they choose that they don't like it at that level, which is assessed to be within that boundary, inconsistent with residential activity.
Yeah, understand that. Thank you.
Right. Now, the next section is assessment of alternatives, and Mr. Sinclair will address you on that, Commissioners.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, Commissioners. Some issues regarding the acceptability of QRail's assessment of alternatives have been raised with the panel by some submitters. As the panel will be aware, KiwiRail should be able to show that its assessment of alternatives was adequate. However, it does not need to show that it undertook exhaustive or meticulous consideration of alternatives, and that assessment can also be an iterative process refined throughout the hearing and after. Ms. Copplestone's Section 42A report expresses the reporting officer's views, where she notes that KiwiRail's analysis appears to be comprehensive, and we are of the view that this represents an adequate consideration of alternative sites. Despite having some specific concerns about certain aspects, Ms. Copplestone was not of the view on the information provided by KiwiRail that the assessment of alternatives process was disingenuous. In contrast, Drs. Whittle and Fox provided information intended to demonstrate that KiwiRail's assessment of alternatives was not genuine. Counsel for Drs. Whittle and Fox submitted, accordingly, that the panel cannot have confidence that there was a robust consideration of alternatives. Paraphrasing Ms. Tancock slightly, the specific criticisms of Drs. Whittle and Fox appear to be that KiwiRail's consideration of alternative sites was not genuine, as the outcome of that process was predetermined, evidenced by the Provincial Growth Fund application and other documents submitted by Ms. Tancock and Drs. Whittle and Fox, and KiwiRail failed to consider the obvious and feasible alternative options of some sort of intermediate-sized site due to its starting assumption that a site larger than 120 hectares was necessary. I'd like to address those points in reverse order. In terms of options of the other sizes, the feasibility of those options should be viewed in the context of the requiring authority's proposed activity. The requiring authority must only consider realistic alternatives, and I would submit that the principle cuts both ways. In the same way that requiring authority cannot simply set up false alternatives to artificially bolster the case for its preferred or selected option, it also can't be said that, in our submission, a requiring authority has conducted an inadequate assessment because it ignored unrealistic alternatives that do not meet its project objectives. As such, it is submitted that it would be appropriate for the panel to consider the realistic spatial requirements of the elements of KiwiRail's proposed activity as a whole as a starting point for what size site could constitute a realistic alternative. It would likely approach requiring exhaustive consideration if KiwiRail were required to assess alternatives that could only accommodate trains half of the length sought or with no log yard on site, for example. It will ultimately be for the panel to assess whether, based on the evidence presented, the size requirements for inclusion in KiwiRail's multi-criteria analysis was an appropriate limit or one that excluded realistic options in an arbitrary and cursory manner. Naturally, there will be a logical limit to that line of argument somewhere. The jurisdiction question addressed earlier on may be engaged at a certain point if a requiring authority were to state its objectives for a project so widely that it could designate for activities as widely as it pleased and claim that sites not accommodating fanciful requests were unrealistic. Whether that has happened here is for the panel to determine, however, it would be suggested that there is no evidence of that. On the point of predetermination, the funding arrangement for the freight hub does not, in our submission, necessarily show that KiwiRail's MCA process was flawed from the outset. First, to Council's knowledge, a requiring authority is permitted to have a preference going into its assessment of alternatives. That is, it is not required to assess all alternatives tabula rasa, clean slate. Nor is the requiring authority prevented from ultimately picking that initial favourite. It's not required to show that its preferred option is the best option. What the requiring authority must show is that it is given more than cursory consideration to options other than that preferred one. In terms of the panel's review of KiwiRail's assessment of alternatives, Drs. Whittle and Fox argue that there has been no consideration of alternatives as the assessment was tainted by predetermination. They assert that extrinsic evidence, funding arrangements relating to the Provincial Growth Fund, show that KiwiRail was never honestly open to any other alternative sites. As a starting point, Cabinet approvals, non-public correspondence and funding arrangements between the Crown and KiwiRail are not prima facie relevant or even usually available to the task of verifying whether KiwiRail has undertaken an adequate assessment of alternatives. However, to the extent that these documents are presented to substantiate a lack of appropriate consideration, they should be, in our submission, reviewed. Here, the documents presented as evidence do not appear to show that the assessment of alternatives undertaken by KiwiRail was inauthentic. As explored by the panel with Drs. Whittle and Fox themselves, KiwiRail has not been strictly constrained by the outline of the project in the business case agreed to by Cabinet. That fact is incompatible with the allegation that the PGF funding arrangement caused the outcome of the alternatives assessment to be predetermined. Finally, some questions do arise in response to an assertion of predetermination, those being which scores in the MCA analysis are incorrect and which other sites are feasibly available. A convincing answer to those questions has not, in Council's opinion, been provided to the panel. Prima facie, KiwiRail's MCA analysis and site selection do not appear suspicious, flawed, or obviously wrong. The point is not raised to imply that it's the role of the person who identifies procedural errors to then go on to cure them by teasing out the elements of the decision arising from the flaws. Rather, the point is only made to highlight the fact that where procedural errors are alleged, one would expect some evidence of those errors would be identifiable in the impugned process. The absence of clearly identifiable flaws in the MCA to some extent undermines the assertion of predetermination in this case. From the reporting officer's point of view, no fundamental problems with the MCA process have been identified. The process does not appear to be disingenuous in terms of the methodology used, nor in the expertise employed in undertaking it. The reporting officers have not identified evidence that the alternative sites were strawmen sites. To use a term employed during this hearing, a golden thread of predetermination does not appear to be present in this particular case.
Thank you, Mr. Sinclair. Any questions for Mr. Sinclair about that, Commissioners? No, thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners.
The next topic is the relevance of the strategic documents. Excuse me. A question as to the role of strategic planning and its relevance to the panel's task has been raised by some submitters, particularly how do the wider transportation network upgrades, that's including the regional ring road project, fit into the panel's consideration under Section 171. Ms Tancock submitted and engaged in discussion with the panel on the question of whether the advantages that would potentially arise from the co-location of the freight hub with the proposed ring road could be taken into account. Ms Tancock highlights that many of the positive effects of the proposal are reliant on completion of and the freight hub's integration with the PNITI and other roading projects, which are all reliant on future processes. Accordingly, she considers that the positive effects of the freight hub arising from integration with those transport networks should be disregarded. In a strict legal sense, the proposition that one cannot take into account positive effects of a proposal which are reliant on other projects not yet part of the environment, in a Hawthorne sense, appears correct. Similarly, KiwiRail submissions are likely legally correct in saying the negative effects of the freight hub cannot be assessed as cumulative with PNITI projects which are not yet part of the environment. However, while this is likely correct in terms of effects, a broader picture could be taken to include the strategic advantages of a site. The principles articulated in Hawthorne regarding which effects can be taken to account are not, in our submission, intended as a limitation on the ability for strategic planning documents to be used to guide RMA processes. This point is made as the panel is required to take into account any other matter it considers reasonably necessary in order to make a recommendation on the requirement. Strategic planning documents such as the Council's growth and economic development plans and local, regional and national road transport planning are submitted to be reasonably necessary for the panel to consider making a recommendation. There is some precedent for the court finding these sorts of non-statutory plans contextually useful at the least in matters of transport strategy and community connectivity, and I've referred to a case that addresses that. That is not to say that these plans should be afforded great weight in terms of the Section 171 exercise. Also, just to interpolate, sir, I'm not saying that they should be given no weight either. The weighting is entirely a matter for the panel. However, consistency with those plans, while perhaps not a direct effect on the environment, can still frame the panel's assessment in terms of positive strategic outcomes, which would ultimately be consistent with achieving the Act's sustainable management purpose. The panel should not be artificially blinded from considering consistency with strategic planning documents under the guise of discounting purely hypothetical positive effects. The freight hub should at least not be inconsistent with the relevant council strategic plans, and the degree of that consistency should be maximised in our submission by imposing conditions where appropriate to the extent that those such conditions would be appropriate. The panel can, and in our submission should, undertake its task with an eye to cohesive strategic planning. Determining the appropriate amount of weight to be afforded to that consideration will, however, be a matter for the panel. Have some comments on the Part 2 assessment.
Just on that point, the submission was made to us that the consequence of the narrow view of effects is that you can't consider the potential for certain effects to be reduced by subsequent but not yet approved or constructed infrastructure. But when you're deciding where to put major infrastructure and there is this in-depth strategic planning of the type that Mr. Murphy's described, coming back to the rationality test in section 1711D, isn't that reasonably necessary for us to make a recommendation to have consider those matters?
That's exactly my submission.
Yeah. And can you find any case, whether Basin Reserve or other, that contradicts that proposition?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry for my brief answers, but
no,
it wasn't
always good.
To...
If it doesn't need elaboration, it's fine.
The RMA states that the panel's consideration of a requirement and submissions received must be subject to Part 2. Part 2 prevails in the event of a conflict between it and the other matters in Section 171. Part 2 incorporates a cascade of considerations through which the overarching principle of sustainable management can be interpreted. The application of these considerations to a proposal is a holistic exercise that must be undertaken honestly and thoroughly. The matters in Part 2 should not be considered as binary checkboxes in our submission that must be met for a proposal to succeed. KiwiRail's submissions hint at times at this type of binary consideration of Part 2 matters. The result of this is that its submissions occasionally attempt to tick the boxes by making some perplexing claims about the freight hub's effect. These include... just some examples regarding Section 6A, that the freight hub has the potential to enhance the natural character of the Mangaone stream environs. Now, the matter of national importance in Section 6A is the preservation of the natural character of wetlands and rivers and their margins. The submission that the removal and culverting of waterways within the designation extent enhances the natural character of the Mangaone stream and its margins is, in our submission, somewhat far-fetched and applies Section 6A incorrectly. The panel has referred to the evidence of Ms Quinn, Ms Whitby and Mr Arsenault about those issues. And Ms Bowman as well. I've omitted to include her name. Second point, regarding Sections 6D and 7D, public access to waterways will be enhanced through the provision of recreational tracks around the stormwater ponds, and the proposed planting, stormwater management, watercourse and culvert design will respect and enhance the intrinsic values of the ecosystems. Now, this submission misunderstands what these provisions are seeking to protect, and in doing so seeks to equate unlike with like. Public access to waterways is not substitutable in our submission for access to artificial stormwater ponds. Again, this is a matter discussed by Ms Whitby. By definition, by removing streams and wetlands, those ecosystems' intrinsic values are lost. And in relation to Section 7G, there are no finite characteristics of natural and physical resources identified. The proposed freight hub has a total footprint of 177.7 hectares here. One matter on which the panel has received a range of submissions and has indicated is a matter of significant interest is Mana Whenua engagement. KiwiRail claims that the Mana Whenua engagement framework will ensure the project is consistent with Section 6E, 7A and 8 of the Act. In our submission, these conditions will provide ongoing opportunities for iwi groups to develop more contextual mitigation. That's what KiwiRail says. As the panel and submitters have noted and discussed with submitters and witnesses, no cultural values assessment has been undertaken in respect of the proposed freight hub. A partnership framework with local iwi and hapu has not been finalised to Council's knowledge as at today's date, although it is understood and recognised that discussions are ongoing there. In his oral submissions for Aorangi Papakainga, Sir Mason Jury articulated the requirements of the treaty principles of partnership participation, active protection and rangatiratanga for Ngā Kaitiaki o Ngāti Kōwhata. Mr Emery said that despite the archaeological report from Kiwi Rail, there were potentially wahitapu sites within the designation extent. Further, there were puna and wetlands within the designation extent. That these matters had not been identified or planned for by Kiwi Rail demonstrated the need for further engagement with iwi. Mr Emery contrasted Kiwi Rail's approach to date with the framework adopted by Waka Kotahi for Te Ahua Tūranga, which he considered provided the sort of collaboration, cooperation and access to the Māori worldview necessary for a decision maker under the Act to have regard to their treaty obligations. Mr Emery also highlighted that without a cultural values assessment, iwi could not have a meaningful input into a condition set for the freight hub, as they would not know what needed to go into the framework for management. Mr Proctor for Rangatāne was blunter, stating that there was no evidence on cultural values before the panel. A common overarching concern among mana whenua submitters appears to be the lack of certainty that their concerns about cultural impacts would be satisfactorily allayed in the absence of any sort of agreed position on how cultural impacts would be dealt with once the project was underway. Returning to part two, and given the concerns summarised above, the confident submission of Kiwi Rail that its mana whenua engagement framework will ensure that the freight hub is consistent with those matters seems premature. The issue and the other part two issues we've addressed in this section are not necessarily fatal to Kiwi Rail's proposal. It's not our submission. It is necessary to compare the conflicting considerations in part two in accordance with their scale and degree in relative significance or proportion in arriving at a final outcome. And even a proposal with serious adverse effects, contrary to some Section 6 and 8 considerations, may be appropriate overall. However, the reporting officers do submit that part two considerations must be confronted realistically. As noted above, the principles from that part two analysis form the basis for the overall appropriateness of the proposal. There is evidence that the overall requirements of part two could be met by the proposed freight hub, and the solutions proposed by Kiwi Rail may prove to be effective mitigation or compensation for the freight for the proposal's adverse effects. However, given the informational issues highlighted in these submissions, the panel might not be able to reach fixed or firm conclusions on some Part 2 matters. Now, recalling the beginning of the submissions where you asked, Sir, about the key issues on where there are informational gaps that aren't necessarily resolved by submissions. The last of those examples on cultural values probably falls within that category as something that the reporting officers don't presently have a detailed answer to.
Mm. Yeah, I understand.
I'm sorry, Commissioners, I keep looking at Mr. Marson, but it's only because he's here.
It's all good.
Unless there are any questions on that, of course they can come at the end, but I was just going to turn on and address some of those discrete legal issues.
Well, I'm sure Commissioner Pomare will be asking questions about that, but we'll come to that at the end if that's all right.
Lapse date. Kiwi Rail seeks that it be assigned a period of 15 years to give effect to its designation should the requirement be confirmed. Kiwi Rail submits that the complexity and scale of the project justifies this extended lapse period. On the other hand, Ms. Copplestone has recommended a lapse period of 10 years. Further still, Commissioner Marson has invited consideration of whether there are opportunities to think outside the square here about lapse and adapt the tool to find some suitable balance. The section addresses the underlying legal principles before offering some idea as to what a more sophisticated approach could be. Well, the Act sets a default lapse period of 5 years. There is not necessarily a presumption towards this lapse period with a wide discretion afforded. The Environment Court has confirmed that the length of time to reasonably complete a project, given its complexity and scale, needs to be balanced against the prejudicial effects to directly affected property owners who are required to endure the planning blight effects on their properties for an indeterminate period. There's the well-known dicta of Judge Moore and Katz and Auckland City Council, which conceptually sets out why planning permissions should lapse after time, and that provides some guidance here. There are compelling reasons of policy why a planning consent should not subsist for a lengthy period of time without being put into effect. Both physical and social environments change, knowledge progresses, district schemes are changed, reviewed and varied, people come and go, planning consents are granted in light of present and foreseeable circumstances as at a particular time. Once granted, a consent represents an opportunity of which advantage may be taken. When a consent is put into effect, it becomes a physical reality as well as a legal right. But if a consent is not put into effect within a reasonable time, it cannot properly remain a fixed opportunity in an ever-changing scene. Likewise, changing circumstances may render conditions, restrictions, and prohibitions in a consent inappropriate or unnecessary. Ultimately, the lapse period recommended by the panel should be one determined in the interest of fairness to all parties with these principles in mind. Evidence before the panel suggests that a lengthy lapse period has the potential to both heighten the negative effects of the NOR and squander its positive effects. Across the hearing, the panel has heard submitters speak on the heavy social impact of the requirement, the effects of these impacts, compounded by the uncertainty of an extensive lapse period, are articulated by Ms. Lindsay, and I'll just scoot to the end of her quote there. I consider this potential loss of identity will likely increase in severity the longer uncertainty is not resolved. For example, the longer the duration of construction and stage development is not clearly communicated to the community. And what we submit is that that must be relevant to the uncertainty arriving from whether the project will go ahead too. On the economic benefits of the freight hub, Mr. Vuletic highlights that a long lapse period will also prolong the uncertainty facing owners of nearby residential properties, potentially impeding their ability to make long-term investments in their properties or divest and move on. Further, the panel is entitled to have recourse to Part 2 in consideration of an appropriate lapse date. In that regard, the panel may wish to have regard to Section 7B and the efficient use and development of a significant tract on the of the available industrial land reserves in Palmerston North. KiwiRail makes a number of submissions to justify its desired lapse period. It submits that Transmission Gully and the East-West Link proposals were granted 15-year lapse periods based on the major scale, and submits that the freight hub is of a similar scale, therefore justifying a similar period. KiwiRail also submits that the confirmation of the requirement itself provides the community and key stakeholders with greater certainty as to its location. While this may be true for some, it will provide little assistance to those whose personal, business or strategic decisions will likely be guided by whether the project will actually be completed, in particular those whose land will be directly affected by the designation. The argument also respectfully misses the point. The freight hub's location, assuming that the length of lapse period is a relevant consideration, will be somewhat of a moot point. The lapse date is a separate and logically subsequent consideration to confirming the location of the NOR. Now, the approach of the Environment Court to a similar request in Meridian 37 is instructive. I'll just have a look and see whether I'll read out the whole thing. I'll probably turn out over the page to 43 and start at the bolded passage. In such a situation, just for summary, there was a 15-year lapse period was sought, and the court was commenting on that. In such a situation, we consider that the fairness of the situation calls for that burden of uncertainty to be borne by the party which wishes to keep its options open for such a length of time. In practical terms, that will mean that unless the parties can agree on the use of an affected land that is satisfactory to both, it should consider buying the land and assuming the risk and uncertainty itself. I'll move on. Paragraph 163, the relevant principle here in that extract we say is that the more hypothetical a project is, for example, one that lacks regional consents, and in WRL's case, lack of a business case, or also lack of funding, the more uncertain they will be. This is the certainty that the courts have referred to in relation to lap states. So it's a different uncertainty to uncertainty of effect. It's uncertainty of the project. And that is what Meridian 37, Meridian 37 makes clear is that it is the burden of the requiring authority to bear in the interest of fairness that uncertainty, not that of the landowners subject to the designation. Now, Ms. Bell's planning evidence sets out a list of activities which she considers are still required before KiwiRail can even begin construction, and she goes through them there. The program that Ms. Bell sets out is of undoubtedly necessary activities, will take some time to complete. However, many of those activities will occur concurrently, not consecutively. KiwiRail's own indicative construction program indicates a minimum completion time for all the activities listed of 6.5 years. Even giving a generous allowance for delays, a lapse period of 15 years would be an indulgence, noting that KiwiRail must only give effect to its designation within its lapse period. On that point, the panel has referred to the concept of establishment and implementation conditions. That's a concept that comes from Koha Trust Holdings Limited, and which I'm very familiar with Commissioner Marson. This perhaps is the opportunity through which a more sophisticated approach to lapse can take shape, considering Ms. Bell's apparent assumption that all of the items listed, as well as actual construction of the freight hub, would need to be fully completed in order for the NOR to be given effect. In our submission, it is open to the panel to provide guidance through its written recommendations and/or the conditions themselves as to what it considers to be necessary to establish the freight hub project, with the decision forming a record for submitters, enforcement officers and KiwiRail as to its view on the matter. A practical way to help this might be if KiwiRail in its reply set out the combination of activities, such as those matters identified by Ms. Bell, and considerations that it considers would be sufficient to give effect to the requirement. The panel, upon considering the items on that list, may incorporate appropriate guidance in respect of what it deems to be necessary. This could involve the panel identifying and labelling conditions on the requirement as implementation conditions, if it wants to go that far. While the above approach may not totally prevent later argument from all quarters about lapse as a matter of law under Section 184, the recorded views of the panel would in our submission carry significant weight if any issues subsequently arose, and would at least clarify matters as between the Council and KiwiRail. Ultimately, we see no escape from the panel needing to specify an actual lapse date if the panel considers that the default 5 years should not apply. To shift from the default 5 years, Section 184 requires a designation to specify a different period when incorporated in the plan, where the word period there is a time that must be set. Given this, the panel should carefully consider any rationale for an extended lapse period presented by KiwiRail and recommend only what they consider the minimum appropriate lapse period after taking into account the competing factors and the practical benefits that the panel can provide about what steps are required to implement or give effect to this designation. council infrastructure issues.
Oh, just before that, can you have a look at section 184?
Yes.
So just trying to understand that section. So the default position is that a designation lapses after 5 years.
That's right.
Unless the designation specified a different period when incorporated in the plan.
Yes.
So that provision, 1C, says the date, the point at which you incorporate a different period is the point at which you incorporate it into the plan, which may mean that it's actually not our job to set a lapse condition. It's the decision of the council when it incorporates it in the plan to specify a lapse date. And one support for that analysis is subsection 3, which says a requiring authority may object under section 357 to a decision not to fix a longer period for the purposes of subsection 1. Now, there's no 357 objection to our recommendation, but there would be if the point at which you make that decision is the date point at which you incorporate it in the plan, and there's a 357 objection. So it may be hard to address that on the hoof, but I just occurred to me whether a lapse period is actually our job.
I was ready to tell you that you were wrong until I read subsection 3, which makes things a little bit more complicated. And so the answer is that I'm not really ready to answer this on the hoof.
Okay. So I'd like some advice on that.
Before that, I would have said that the incorporation of the plan, because it's what has to happen at the end of this process anyway, it is a matter for this panel to determine the lapse.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that that's the conventional approach, where a panel would determine the lapse period.
I agree with you that that's the conventional approach, but I'm bound to draw your attention to something which is confusing me.
Well, it is confusing me, and it's confusing because ultimately you're giving recommendations subject to a final decision by Kiwi Rail anyway.
Correct.
But this subsection 3 does suggest a decision by the council. So, yes, on the hoof, I'm a bit caught here, but
okay.
I might need to look into that further.
That's all right. I just thought I'd throw that spanner in the works.
Thank you. For some time now, the council's infrastructure department and KiwiRail have been working on the development of a project agreement to address the issues summarised in Mr. Van Bentham's report. Mr. Van Bentham said that the parties intend to have an agreement executed prior to the hearing. However, the optimism has not been rewarded. While Mr. Van Bentham explains that it would be desirable for them to be addressed through a project agreement, the lack of agreement, leaves some resource management issues unresolved. Some of Mr. Van Bentham's issues are well suited for a project agreement, we agree. For example, agreements for the water bore facility, including provision for the council's planned upgrade, arrangements for remediation and compensation of local roads that will have their lifespan decreased by construction traffic from the freight hub. Thirdly, any matter relating to the vesting of infrastructure. And fourthly, permissions from the council as a road controlling authority concerning any of its primary designations for roads. In relation to points A and B above, despite both involving genuine resource management issues appropriate for conditions, their suitability for site agreement arises partly from the condition complexity that would be needed, and because they are matters that are best suited to the flexibility of a contractual relationship. The panel may consider these to be genuine resource management issues requiring attention, which raises the prospect of conditions being needed in the absence of a project agreement. The reporting officers will be tabling some revised condition recommendations on each issue, informed by Mr. Van Bentham's expertise in this area. And even if these are not necessarily perfect or simple conditions. And this is a reference to some of the discussion that Mr. Van Bentham had with the panel last week. KiwiRail in its submissions cites Norsho Bulk, if that's how you say it, and it submits that it would be inappropriate to impose a condition in relation to B above, as it would be difficult to attribute damage to roads to KiwiRail, and it says there are other tools available to council to address road lifespan matters as part of its broader road controlling authority functions. First, it's worth noting that the court in Norsho Bulk acknowledged that roads are finite physical resources and that the use of roads is a use of land. Secondly, Norsho Bulk concerned in part the proposed inclusion of an additional purpose within a review condition to a resource consent, being to consider the effectiveness of consent conditions relating to the effect of truck movements on a pavement along Blackbridge Road, and the need for any upgrading works to be undertaken, and the consideration of limiting truck movements to the activity site until such improvements have been completed. Given its materially different subject matter, the commentary in Norsho Bulk is not easily applicable to this NOR. Council's concerns are broader than the effects of the proposal on one specific stretch of local road. As such, many of the options identified by the court and referred to by KiwiRail are, in this case, illusory. For example, making directions under Section 16A of the LTA or Regulation 10 of the heavy motor vehicle regs that would restrict heavy traffic from accessing the freight hub is not feasible here. To add to that, one would assume that KiwiRail would not want that either. Secondly, a Class C classification under Regulation 3 of the heavy motor vehicle regs would have no effect, as the traffic of concern coming in and out of the freight hub will likely be delivering or collecting goods. The question therefore arises, what are the other tools, apart from conditions, that KiwiRail proposes the council should use to remediate the effects of the freight hub on council's road? If the tool in question is a site agreement, can KiwiRail commit to entering into one with the council to satisfactorily remediate these effects? Absent a clearly available and appropriate tool or agreement that addresses these issues better, the reporting officers are obliged to recommend conditions. The next mini section is development contributions. The panel has asked whether KiwiRail could be liable for a payment of DCs. The answer is yes, that it could be. The LGA does not exempt requiring authorities from potential development contributions liability. Even though resource consents are not required from the council, requirements for DCs can be triggered under Section 198 upon the grant of a building consent for building work within the district, which will occur here. Section 199 provides that DCs may be required in relation to developments if the effect of the development is to require new or additional assets or assets of increased capacity, leading to the council incurring capital expenditure. That is not to say that the existing DC policy for the council is set up to deal with the freight hub's existence, as it will have been prepared considering anticipated growth from the existing extent of the NEIZ without specific consideration of the freight hub or the capital projects that its growth beyond the zone might require. This will be a matter for the council to review. Finally, conditions. The provision of several different condition sets by KiwiRail since the beginning of this process speaks to the evolving base of information since the NOR was lodged and to KiwiRail's openness to take on board technical and planning recommendations, including many of those recommended in the officers' reports. While the issues in contention for conditions has narrowed considerably, including over the course of this hearing, there are remaining issues of disagreement or concern between the reporting officers and KiwiRail's experts that will not be resolved. The reporting officers have advanced one set of conditions at the start of the hearing, and Ms. Copplestone will do that again when she addresses the panel. It's understood that will be further set from KiwiRail in its reply as well. As to matters of procedural fairness to submitters who have already appeared, it is hoped that KiwiRail's next set of conditions will not include further changes that weaken or otherwise materially change mitigations that it has already offered in previous sets. As mentioned previously, further additions that address effects of concern may be welcomed. Now, sir, that's my submissions. Mm. So I'm happy to talk through any questions.
All right, so we'll take a quick 10-minute break and then we'll start with Commissioner Pomeroy.